So I'm going to start tonight by quoting a line from the Diamond Sutra. I seem to be doing that a lot lately. And this is a line that I've quoted before, but I thought we would look at it a little more deeply, perhaps with even more subtlety. And I'll bring in a couple of writings to try to elucidate it even a little bit better. But it's a very powerful line in the Diamond Sutra, and it goes like this. And it's the words of the Buddha. And he said, "One who sees me in form, one who seeks me in voice, perverted are his steps upon the way, for he cannot see the Tathagata." So I'll say that one more time. "One who sees me in form, one who seeks me in voice, perverted are his steps upon the way, for he cannot see the Tathagata." Now, the Tathagata is an appellation of the Buddha. I've mentioned this before, which means literally one who has gone thus. One who has gone thus. So we're going to talk about what thus means in this context. But what about this word perverted? What does that mean? I don't know precisely what, I presume it comes from Latin. I think it means turned in the wrong direction. Turned in the wrong direction. In a sense, inverted. Oftentimes, the mind of the unenlightened person is described in Buddhist literature as being topsy-turvy, backwards. It's like that line in As My Guitar Gently Weeps by George Harrison. "I don't know how you became perverted, you were inverted too." It's kind of like that. He was a very spiritual guy. I wonder if he read the Diamond Sutra. So what does this mean? One who sees me in form, one who seeks me in voice. Let's say one who is looking outward at the world of form, trying to find the truth, trying to find the Buddha, the Tathagata, meaning your own true nature, your own Buddha nature. So one who is looking outward, trying to find their own Buddha nature, is turned in the wrong direction. That's literally what this line means. For this person looking outward at the world of ever-changing forms, trying to find this true nature, can't see thus. Or one who, you might say, one who is thus. So this looking in the wrong direction, I'm going to read the first few lines of the Xinjin Ming. This is as translated by our late teacher Richard Clark. It's a beautiful translation. It's a little different than the standard translations, and I'll go into how it's different. But this is the very first paragraph of this short poem written by the third Chinese Zen patriarch, Sengsan. And he lived in the 500s. So it's just a little bit before the Tang Dynasty. And it goes like this. And think of it in the context of what we just talked about. "The great way," and that's capitalized, "the great way is not difficult for those not attached to preferences. When neither love nor hate arises, all is clear and undisguised. Separate by the smallest amount, however, and you are as far from it as heaven is from earth." Goes on and says, "If you wish to know the truth, then hold to no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind." So, the great way is not difficult for one not attached to preferences. And we were talking about being turned in the wrong direction. So looking for the truth in the world of forms, seeking, looking, is it this, is it that? No, I don't want this. No, that's, I think that's it. Yeah, that's right. It's someone who has tremendous bearing and never feels afraid. Someone who's always happy. Not me. See what I mean? So already we're lost in picking and choosing. So this picking and choosing suddenly takes this one whole perfection of Buddha nature and chops it up. And we get stuck. Now, it's not that the problem is not having preferences. Certainly, I prefer not to be hungry. I prefer to be well-fed. I prefer to be happy. I prefer not to feel depressed. But it's attachment. In other words, it's allowing your preference to fool you into believing either that you can keep forever what you want, that it won't go away. That's called attachment. Or that somehow something ought not to be, shouldn't be that way, can't be that way, I can't allow it, I can't bear it. As if in observing something, it's not already complete, as we always say, it's done and dusted. The world, the way it comes, is done by the time you've observed it. You can't take it back, you can't make it go away. I'm talking about being in the present moment, not some future time, which is product of our thinking. So you can see how this all connects. So seeking outwardly, meaning picking and choosing and being attached to preferences, is going in the wrong direction. So what is the right direction? We've talked about this many, many times. I think the most important thing to learn is how to do proper zazen. That's the critical, key, fundamental thing. It's more important than anything else. It's more important than believing there was or wasn't a Buddha, Buddhism, Zen, whatever you want to call it. The most important thing is to learn how to do proper zazen. That will answer everything. So this one who has gone thus, what is this thus? Now, Wang Po, and I like to quote this, this will reflect upon this a little bit perhaps, he said, your true nature hasn't a single atom of objectivity. Your true nature hasn't a single atom of objectivity. Is that pointing you now? What is thus? Everything is shining thus, meaning it appears. It appears. Things appear. We think they're somehow solid and out there. We turn and they're gone. They're still there, even though we don't see them. There's a Buddha out there. I've got to go find that Buddha. But everything we can possibly know, everything we can possibly see, hear, smell, taste, touch, or think, appears. Getting the notion of this thus. Thus. Sometimes it's described as such, suchness, thusness. Things pop with this thusness. They burst upon your consciousness. There they are. What is this thus? One thing you can say is, as appearance, it must be known. Okay? It must be known, but known where? Known most intimately, in the deepest center. This Zen master Jizo said to the student Hogen before he himself became a great Zen master, not knowing is most intimate. Not knowing is most intimate. This is the intimacy of this direction, not outward, the kind of knowing that looks out upon a world outside you. This is the not knowing of penetrating within. Clearly seeing what's shining from everything, this thus, thus. How do we get there? How do you do zazen to get there? I've talked about this many, many times. It starts with what the third Zen patriarch said, is not being attached to preferences, not making the slightest distinction which then separates heaven and earth infinitely apart. So as we observe form passing in front of us in our zazen, we get it that this form, in this moment, doing zazen, is actually complete. It's done. So we don't need to entangle. Entanglement, as I always say, is futile and irrelevant. Therefore, we develop a certain kind of dispassion. And although we may prefer or not prefer something, we never for a moment fool ourselves into thinking that something that we're observing could stay forever or shouldn't be there. We don't fool ourselves that way. So we're not attached to preference. So preference is not a problem. Preference is another form. You feel a preference. You think a thought. You smell a smell. You see a sight. Where's the problem there? Each one of these things presents, appears, each one of them is showing this thus. So none of them are a problem. None of them are outside your true nature. So when you have this dispassionate attitude towards things, you can begin to perceive their thusness or suchness. The sheer fact, as I've said before, and then I read it, and I noticed that nothing is new under the sun. Wittgenstein said it this way. He said, it's not how things are, it's that they are. He's a philosopher, you know, but I think he did some deep introspection when he came up with this one. It's not so much, it's irrelevant exactly how things are, unless you're trying to create something, do something. But we're talking now about this deep inner work. It's not how things are, it's that they are. That. Thus. Such. We begin to see this when we're not entangled with, clinging to, or rejecting forms as they present to us in our mind, in our zazen, and when we're doing an activity in the everyday world mindfully. That's the beginning of this turning around. So we notice that thus is very intimate. There's no thus without me. There's no thus without me. And I get curious about that and I turn the mind back. Turning the mind back. Turning the mind in on itself. Shining the flashlight in on itself to perceive its own nature. Yuan Wu calls this the backward step. And every serious Zen student needs to have a facility in doing this to make it very clear how to go in this direction. Now I was going to read to you from a wonderful Zen master. This is a Chinese Zen master who was actually a contemporary master, and he didn't die very long ago, I think maybe 20 or 30 years ago. He lived to the age of around 120. And he was very famous and had thousands of students, and he was, some people say, a living Buddha. This is a picture of him. This is on the cover of a very old book. I got this when I was in college, by Luke Kuan Yew, Chan and Zen Teaching First Series. And this master here is Xu, S-H-U, Yun, Y-U-N, Xu Yun. So Xu Yun was a great master. The translations here by this Charles Luke was his English name, are masterful, masterful. So I thought what I would start with is something that he said to his students, probably in a session. But he said here, he was talking first about the difficulty for beginners in Zazen, and all of us really should think of ourselves as beginners. Particularly when we first sit down and we're all frazzled. You're a beginner at that point. So he talked about what's difficult for beginners, which is to set aside this busy mind and pick up the one thought. That's difficult. But what's the easiness for beginners? So he's pointing now at the easiness. I'm not going to read the other one, but I'll read this. Easiness for beginners. Laying down the burden of thinking and giving rise to a single thought. Now remember what I said about dispassion. Something is done and dusted. You can entangle yourself, but it's futile and irrelevant. So you have to get that before you can turn the light around. Or you're entangled. You're still looking out. You're still attached to preferences, as Sengsan said. So I'm going to read what he wrote. He wrote, "Although the training seems difficult, it becomes very easy once its method is known. Where does easiness lie for beginners? There's nothing ingenious in it because it lies in, quote, laying down." Laying down what? The burden of distress, which in Sanskrit is called klesha, distress. In psychiatry is called neurosis. The burden of distress caused by ignorance. How does one lay it down? And then he goes into this very colorful depiction. This is one way to do it. I recommend a slightly different way based on modern physics, but I'll read his way. He said, "You have all been at the bedside of a dead man. If you try to scold him a few times, he will not be excited. If you give him a few strokes of the staff, he will not strike back. Formerly he indulged in ignorance, but now he cannot do so anymore. Formerly he longed for reputation and wealth." Okay, this seeking in sight and seeking in voice. "But now he cannot do so anymore. Now he no longer wants reputation and wealth. Formerly he was contaminated by habits, but now he is free of them. Now he does not make distinctions and lays everything down. Dear friends, please look at all this. When we have breathed our last, this physical body of ours will become a corpse. Because we cherish this body, we are unable to lay down everything, with the resultant creation of self and other, right and wrong, like and dislike, acceptance and rejection. If we only regard this body as a corpse, we will not cherish it, and it will certainly not consider it as ours. If so, is there anything we cannot lay down?" It's actually the practice of Tibetan Buddhist monks. They go to the charnel grounds and they observe dead bodies. It's a very powerful practice that they can do. They're deeply trained, so they don't freak out. And they really get it that this body that we're so cherishing eventually comes to an end and just is a smelly, rotten bag of pus, so to speak. So he said, "We only have to lay down everything day and night, no matter whether we walk, stand, sit, or recline. In the midst of either stillness or disturbance, and whether busy or not, throughout our bodies, within and without, there should only be doubt, a uniform, harmonizing, and continuous doubt, unmixed with any other thought." In other words, and he uses this Chinese term, wado, a wado, H-U-A, second word, T-apostrophe-O-U, a wado, which is likened to a long sword leaning against the sky, which we will use to cut down a demon or a Buddha should either appear. Thus we will not fear false thinking. Who then will disturb us? Who will distinguish between disturbance and stillness? And who will cling to existence and non-existence? Who? Because only I am doing that. But if I am holding to this wado, and we're going to go into this, this is a part of this method, I can't do those other things. There's no room left, there's no energy left, there's no intention left for clinging, rejecting, judging, comparing, seeking outside. So there's this one harmonizing in Zen, it's called doubt, which is not like doubting this, doubting that. It's something even deeper. It's like the deepest question of what is my deepest center, my deepest self, my deepest true nature. A profound wondering that gradually deepens as we do this practice longer and longer, particularly when we begin to work with koan. So I'm going to now talk a little bit about this wado practice. And this is really to reinforce all the things that I've said before about this, what I call penetrating zazen, turning the light of the mind within, Wan Wu saying, taking the backward step, the Buddha saying, you can't see the Tathagata because you're looking in the wrong direction. So what does Su Yun say about the wado? Now the wado could be the koan mu, for example, or who am I, or who is hearing the sound? Or it could be something that is deep to yourself. Sometimes we call it a genjo koan. What is the meaning of life? What is my true nature? People have come up with different deep questions that have tormented them. Basui used to say, who is the master that moves the hands and feet? Who is the master? So he writes here, and this was actually, I think, in a talk he gave to his students, taking care of a wado and turning inward, the hearing to hear the self nature, the hearing to hear the self nature. So he says here, someone may ask, how can Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, that's canon, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva's method of turning inward to the hearing to hear the self nature. So this canon was famous for becoming to enlightenment by very intimately listening to sounds and penetrating into who is hearing the sound. And that's how the Bodhisattva canon means one who hears the cries of others. This is how he came to his enlightenment. He says, how can this method of turning the hearing to hear the self-nature be regarded as Chan training? Chan is Zen. It's a Chinese word for Zen. It comes from dhyana, which means absorption. He says, I've just talked about looking into the Wado. It means that you should unremittingly and one-pointedly, and this is during your Zazen, turn the light inward on that which is not born and does not die, which is the Wado. The Wado literally means the head, the head. So if someone, for example, is working on Mu, the sound Mu would be the tail of the koan, and the penetration into what is the substance of this Mu. It's not one iota that's outside of me. So what is it? If it's not outside of me, what is it? That's the head of the koan. That's called the Wado. So the Wado is like the point of the sword. It's the using the koan to turn the mind in on itself, shine the light of the flashlight in on itself. So he says here, you should unremittingly and one-pointedly turn the light inward on that which is not born and does not die. The only thing that could not be born and not be die is that which has no particular form, color, sound, smell, taste, touch. It is the very thus of all these things. It is not born and does not die, because it doesn't change, it doesn't become, it doesn't go away, it doesn't exist, it does not exist. It's the very center of awareness. So he says here, unremittingly turn inward your faculty of hearing to hear the self nature. To turn inwards is to turn back. Remember Wan Wu. To turn inwards is to turn back. That which is not born and does not die is nothing but the self nature, or true nature, or Buddha nature. When hearing and looking follow sound and form in the worldly stream, hearing does not go beyond sound and looking does not go beyond form or appearance, with the obvious differentiation, and then you fall into picking and choosing, attaching to preferences. However, when going against the mundane stream, so this outward world of ever-changing forms, in this particular kind of practice is called the mundane stream. He said, when hearing does not go beyond sound and looking does not go beyond form with the obvious difference, however, when going against the mundane stream, the meditation is turned inwards to contemplate the self-nature. When hearing and looking are no longer in pursuit of sound and appearance, the Diamond Sutra again, they become fundamentally pure and enlightening and do not differ from each other. So hearing, looking, smelling, thinking, when they are turned within to see the self-nature, in other words, to perceive the fact of the world, the appearance of the world, the thus, which is a knowing in the center, none of them are different from one another. They are all the same thing, the same source with a capital S. So when hearing and looking are no longer in pursuit of sound and appearance, they become fundamentally pure and enlightening and do not differ from each other. We should know that what we call looking into the Wado and turning inward the hearing to hear the self-nature cannot be effected by means of the eye to look or the ear to hear outward. If the eye and ear are so used, there will be pursuit after sound and form with the results that one will be turned by things, externals, turned by things. You know, this The saying is, things are in the saddle and riding mankind. You will be turned by things, by chasing after forms, sounds, trying to find this thing that you can't find. If the eye and ear so use, it will be pursuit and you'll be turned by externals. This is called surrender to the mundane stream. If there is singleness of thought abiding in that which is not born and does not die, without pursuing sound and form, this is going against the stream. This is called looking into the wado, or turning inward the hearing to hear the self nature. So, hearing these words, if you don't yet know how to actually do this, will sound extremely puzzling. It will create us kind of a doubt. What is he talking about? And that's a good thing. Because if your intellect can figure it out, then you're still looking outward. You're still making pictures. You're still using words. You're not in contact with the real thing. So the only way to find this is with deep inquiry. Looking into the mind that is looking. What is its nature? How does it appear? Does it have sound, color, smell, taste, touch? This is the direction that we move in penetrating Zazen. Now, what if we're doing breath practice, not working with koan? What I recommend is, while observing the breath, and not just mindlessly observing the breath or slavishly observing the breath, but observing it with a very acute awareness, like a cat watching a mouse, and noticing something about the breath. That it appears, the breath is, it appears. Just that. So in my definition of mindfulness is intently observing something partaking of form while being aware of the fact that it appears or its thusness. And that is the beginning of turning the mind around to peer into its own nature. So I think we have, I think we're out of time, so we'll say the four vows.